Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Saturday, Senator Bernie Sanders won the Nevada caucuses with a landslide margin. He dominated in all categories and slightly won self-identified moderate and conservative Democrats. He is now the front runner. Michael Bloomberg was not on the ballot in Nevada, but over the weekend on the cable and Sunday shows, the pundits continually asked if Michael Bloomberg can still win. On today's Your Call, we are continuing our coverage of presidential candidates by talking about Bloomberg's record policies and election spending spree. Next Monday, we will talk about the candidates' environmental records. But in order to get through all of them before Super Tuesday, we had to change today's show to focus on Bloomberg. We did shows about Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg last week. You can find them at yourcallradio.org. We'll discuss Amy Klobuchar tomorrow and Joe Biden on Wednesday. Michael Bloomberg was a Democrat before his 2001 mayoral run in New York City, but he switched to the Republican Party for his bid, and he won. He became an independent in 2007 and served three terms as mayor. In 2004, he spoke at the Republican National Convention and supported the reelection of George W. Bush. Michael Bloomberg is the sixth richest person in the U.S., with an estimated net worth of $64 billion, according to Forbes. He is essentially running his own super PAC. He has spent $464 million so far. No presidential candidate in U.S. history has spent so much money so quickly. Self-funding campaigns with unlimited money is completely legal in this country. And the money he is spending has translated into endless media coverage. Joining us to talk about his policies, his plans, and how his ability to spend unlimited amounts of money is reshaping the role of money in politics. We're joined by Dave Leventhal, editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity, an independent investigative journalism outlet covering money and politics and other crucial issues. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect. He writes for many publications, including The Intercept and The New Republic. David's book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. I want to start with you, David. You wrote a pretty lengthy piece for The Prospect called Michael Bloomberg and the Dangers of Any Blue Will Do Politics. The presidential candidate is a mirror image of Trump. Here's a basic question for you. Why is Michael Bloomberg running to be president?
That's a really good question. He has flirted with this, I think, about five different times, going all the way back to the 2000s. And so, it's obviously been in his character to assume that being one of the richest men in the world, he should be one of the most powerful men in the world as well, I guess. So I can't speak to what's in his head. What I do know is that his candidacy and the way he's going about it with this virtually limitless spending is, I really think, dangerous for democracy in America. If we have a plutocrat on plutocrat general election that just sort of shows you that the highest office in the land is just for sale, I don't know how democracy moves on from that.
Hmm. Well, Dave, I mean, you cover money in politics. In January alone, Bloomberg spent $126 million on TV commercials. Because of his money alone, the ad buys are actually going up in price. And then $45 million went to digital ads. More than half went to Facebook. What are your thoughts about what this says and the precedent it sets?
Well, it changes everything, particularly on the Democratic side, where in past elections, past presidential elections, it was always a war for other people's dollars. It was a war to fundraise more than your opponents, so you would have the ability to, for example, hire more staff or put advertisements up on television or do digital ads and travel around the country. Michael Bloomberg blows that all up completely. He quite literally has an unlimited amount of money that he can spend on his presidential effort. He's shown that he's willing to already spend into the hundreds of millions of dollars, and putting Tom Steyer, another billionaire, in his own right aside for a moment, he's far superseded what any of the other candidates in the race have been able to do on the financial front, whether that's Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren. All of them together can't hold a candle to what Mike Bloomberg is doing. So as a result, number one, Michael Bloomberg is able to instantaneously vault himself to into the conversation, and he's shown also to beyond that that he's making some real progress on the political front, getting people to support him over other candidates. If Michael Bloomberg didn't have any money, or had, you know, just a fraction of the money that he had to bring to bear, we wouldn't even be talking about Mike Bloomberg right now. He's in the conversation strictly because of his money and his ability to communicate his ideas through the almost blanket advertising that he's putting out there.
And this is perfectly legal in the United States to do this.
It is, and it's perfectly legal today. And in fact, it was perfectly legal prior to the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission Supreme Court decision, which in its own right had a massive effect on the political system when it came to money, allowing corporations and unions, special interest groups of other sorts, nonprofit organizations of certain sorts, to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to directly advocate for and against politicians. But you kind of alluded to it before. Michael Bloomberg is, in a way, his own super PAC. He's the personification of a super PAC. He can bring all this money immediately into the political system any way he sees fit, and he can do that because he's a billionaire.
Now, according to reports, he is telling big money donors to not give any money. And so that means that the other candidates aren't getting their money. Now, in addition to the money that we know he is spending, what about the dark money? Do we know, Dave, if any groups are working for Bloomberg behind the scenes?
Michael Bloomberg is more or less self-funding his campaign. You're absolutely correct that he's not taking other people's money. This is more or less the same playbook that he used when he was running for mayor of New York and was spending some extremely high dollar amounts by New York City politics standards. Then, and mentioned a moment ago, Mike Bloomberg, he's had the ability to do this before Citizens United and showed that ability, because in the United States, as a billionaire, as a very wealthy person, you can spend as much as you want to on your own campaign. The courts have upheld that. And as a result, he's doing this now in a presidential context. We don't have any evidence of any other type of corporation or any type of entity coming in to further support Mike Bloomberg beyond the huge amount that he's able to do for himself. But in a way, Rose, that's the point, that Michael Bloomberg doesn't need any help because he just simply can spend all this money on his own because he's willing to spend it. And hey, millions and millions and now hundreds of millions of dollars may seem like an awful, awful lot of money, even for national politics in that context. But it's just a drop in the bucket for somebody who different numbers are out there. But, you know, it's worth probably about $60 plus billion. He's one of the richest individuals in the world. So this is just kind of a rounding error for him.
So the other question,
can I just add a couple points?
Sure.
First of all, we know that Michael Bloomberg has spent more money today on advertising than any presidential candidate in history, and it's February 24th. Wow. It is 8+ months until the general election. Mm. He has already eclipsed everyone. So that's number one. Number two, while he is not receiving help from other, whether corporations or other organizations or what have you, what he is doing is buying the support, or in some cases the silence, of these organizations on the left. There are mayors who have endorsed him, who received tens of millions of dollars in donations from his philanthropic fund to help fill budget holes in their cities. He, I believe, about $350 million in city grant programs. He has he has had events with people like Stacey Abrams, who he gave $5 million to her organization, Fair Fight, which deals with voting rights. One by one.
David, are you still with us?
Hello.
Oh, we were having some problems with your line.
I'm sorry. What I was saying is one by one, he's just sort of buying off the political class. And so this is a new way to see this sort of coordination in action. It's not that he's receiving big money help. It's that he's creating big money help through you know, his other philanthropic fund, which is buying donations and support for his campaign.
Well, that was the other question I wanted to ask both of you. So many people are now saying, okay, Bernie's the front runner, but Bloomberg can still get him, or even there might be a brokered convention, which we can talk about in a few minutes. But I just wonder, do the Democrats, are they really in line with Bloomberg and his policy? Or are they in line with him because of all of the money that he has? According to the Huffington Post, the Democrats received $8.9 million from Bloomberg's super PAC in the 2018 midterms. And as you said, David, he's given so much money to various nonprofits that politicians are directly connected to. Speaker Pelosi recently said, as far as Bloomberg is concerned, I think his involvement in this campaign will be a positive one. So, David, what's your read on that?
Yeah, I mean, he has endorsements from members of Congress who he backed with millions of dollars in independent expenditures in the 2018 campaign. This is like the worst kind of favor trading, the kind that we expect is going on the right, perhaps. I think that the Democratic establishment is sort of looking for, you know, that one savior to stop Bernie Sanders. I think that's pretty clear. I think that Bloomberg looked like a much better bet until the first debate, when, you know, there's the classic Mike Tyson line that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And, you know, Bloomberg got punched in the mouth, and he didn't look so hot, after that. And his poll numbers have taken a slip since the one day where he hasn't completely dictated the terms of his candidacy through 30-second television ads, when he had to face, you know, moderators and other challengers for the nomination. He didn't look that good by comparison. So, you know, the landscape has changed a little bit in the last week. But what I would say is that the Democratic Party certainly doesn't want to alienate Michael Bloomberg, because he's been their biggest monetary supporter over the last couple cycles, and that's playing a role here.
Dave, what would you add?
Perhaps the biggest case that Michael Bloomberg can make for himself for becoming the Democratic nominee is that he can out-billionaire another billionaire in Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump has been running for re-election quite literally since the day of his inauguration in January of 2017, when he filed paperwork to raise money for this 2020 election, and he's been raising money like crazy ever since. Michael Bloomberg can immediately go far above and beyond what Donald Trump could do in his reelection campaign in his wildest dreams when it comes to raising money and getting money flowing into the political system. So that is a case that Bloomberg has in certain ways made, and it's definitely a case that he can make to all the people out there deciding among Michael Bloomberg and the various other Democratic candidates who to back. And absolutely, David's right. Michael Bloomberg has been seeding this field for years. Michael Bloomberg had pumped tens and tens of millions of dollars into a super PAC that largely was focused on gun rights issues, but definitely supported candidates in other ways over the past several years. And Michael Bloomberg is very much his own super PAC and has supported super PACs too. And there's a certain irony to all of this in that the Democratic Party and 2016. When you look back at the party platform, the one that everyone adopted at the Democratic National Convention, they specifically talked about people such as Michael Bloomberg who were billionaires trying to buy elections. And indulge me for 10 seconds here. They talked about how to curb billionaires' influence over elections. They bemoaned people who had outsized influence and were billionaires or big corporations. And they were talking constantly about how to just have a situation where people, regardless of their income, and I'll quote here for a second, quote, can participate in the political process and can run for office without needing to depend on large contributions from the wealthy and the powerful. Well, if Michael Bloomberg isn't sort of the face of all of those things the Democratic Party said that it was working against, I don't know what.
Well, what are your thoughts, though? Because money doesn't always win. I mean, look at the 2016 election. Hundreds of millions were spent on that. Hillary Clinton had super PACs behind her. And, I mean, she didn't win the Electoral College.
And this is the one thing that that Democrats, if they don't like Michael Bloomberg, can take heart in, that, in fact, self-funded candidates, at least at the congressional level, House level, Senate level, they just don't do all that well. In fact, only about 1 in 5 candidates who spend more than $1 million of their own money on a federal election actually win the office that they're seeking. So you're absolutely right that money isn't everything, but money is the lone determining factor between Michael Bloomberg being in the conversation and not being in the conversation. And here he is very much in the conversation.
Dave Lemon.
And also, I would add that what he is actually doing in terms of spending is qualitatively different than anything we've seen before. I mean, this really is sui generis. We have not seen this level of funding for a presidential or any political campaign in America ever.
Right. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Dave Leventhal is editor at large at the Center for Public Integrity, an independent investigative journalism outlet. Today, we're talking about Michael Bloomberg's record, his policies, and the endless amount of money that he has to spend on his campaign. So far, $464 million. No candidate in U.S. history has spent so much so quickly. If you have any questions or comments, if you lived in New York when Michael Bloomberg was mayor and you'd like to talk about the changes you saw, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Greg who says, has San Francisco Mayor London Breed received any kickbacks from Bloomberg? She was on NPR a few weeks ago, and when she was asked about stop and frisk, San Francisco Mayor Breed, who has endorsed Bloomberg, said, well, all politicians make mistakes. Do either of you know? I've been looking for this. The only thing I've been able to find is that London Breed, Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, and San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, who've all endorsed Bloomberg, were part of his sponsored Harvard University mayoral training program. Do either of you have info on Breed's connection to Bloomberg, if there's anything else?
I don't, but what you just described is this sort of soft corruption, let's call it. This is, you know, an invitation to an event that Bloomberg's philanthropic organization puts on or is part of, where mayors get this training and interaction, and you know, get an up close look at what it would be like to get, you know, significant support from Bloomberg, and so, you know, it's sort of a mindset of you know, he was nice enough to bring me to this organization and help me in my career, and I'm going to give something back, and we've seen this over and over and over and over again in terms of his endorsers.
Anything to add there, Dave?
And I too don't know specifically if there's anything to that, but, you know, this is kind of a situation where Bloomberg has far and wide been attempting to make nice with lots and lots of people ahead of a potential presidential run, and has been relatively successful in that regard. The big question going into Super Tuesday in particular, though, which is going to be a week from tomorrow, is whether he's going to be able to hit the magic 15 number in many of those states. And why is the number 15 significant? Well, it's probably the most significant number over the next week because that is the threshold percentage-wise that any candidate, whether it's Mike Bloomberg or Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and the rest, have to reach in order to get delegates. And you got a lot of states that are coming up that have a huge delegate haul. California, of course, chief among them, but also Texas and Minnesota and North Carolina, where if Michael Bloomberg isn't able to win enough friends and influence people to get him over that 15% threshold, then Michael Bloomberg is going to come out the other end Super Tuesday having spent all that money and not having many delegates to show for that. So that's a huge concern for him. He is polling above the 15% threshold in several of those states right now, but so are some of the other candidates too. So we've got a very, very convoluted situation that we're probably not going to know necessarily who is going to be viable overall and who's going to effectively need to drop out until after Super Tuesday. Say nothing of Carolina coming up, South Carolina coming up over the weekend.
Right, and there is a debate tomorrow night. Bloomberg and Tom Steyer will be part of that. David, I know you have to leave us in just a couple minutes, so I want to make sure and spend a little bit of time on your piece because you really went in depth here. We'll talk about stop and frisk after the break, but you point out in your piece that under Bloomberg's tenure as mayor, he opposed union contracts and public spending repeatedly in office while favoring welfare for the rich to attract them to the city. He opposed minimum wage increases before and now supports them. What else do we need to know about Bloomberg that's not getting enough attention?
Yeah, we need to know a great deal because his policy platform is kind of mainstream liberal, taken from many organizations that he supported over the years. In fact, in some cases, plagiarized from those white papers from those various organizations like the Center for American Progress and so on. The labor record is really fascinating because by the end of Michael Bloomberg's tenure as New York City mayor in 2013, all 150-plus city employee labor organizations had let their contracts expire in the city because they did not want to negotiate with someone that wanted to take pension support away from them, that wanted to change their health care so that they would have to pay more in premiums. This is remarkable. I've never heard of that before in a mayoralty that every single city union would let their contract expire. So that was a perfect example. And I do think beyond stop and frisk, the sort of surveillance state that Bloomberg put up in New York City, arresting thousands of people before the Republican National Convention because they were preparing to organize and protest, the paramilitary-style crackdown of Occupy Wall Street that he engaged in, spying on Muslims who had committed no crime whatsoever. I think those are important factors. And then, the source of Bloomberg's fortune comes from selling these Bloomberg terminals and selling financial information, and much of that comes from overseas and particularly from China. His expressed ardor for the Chinese government that we've seen in public. He's said that Xi Jinping is not a dictator. That sort of recalls almost like what the Trump organization is doing abroad and how it plays into his foreign policy. So, I mean, there are so many flashing red lights here that it's hard to even get to them all. But they if you take them all together, it signals someone that I believe is way out of step with where the Democratic Party.
And David, I know you got to go, but there's been so much coverage of Bloomberg from the cable shows to NPR. Yet these topics, these issues you just brought up, are hardly mentioned. Why do you think that is?
Because Bloomberg, first of all, has a large news organization that hires journalists a lot. And getting on his bad side probably is not good for someone's career path. I guess I don't care about that. But so that's number one. And number two, we have a horse race mentality where we only talk about whether someone has the financial resources to support, where their polls are. Maybe you get one issue like stop and frisk, which has sort of been the highlight of talking about Bloomberg, but there's so much more there, and it's frankly outlets like yours where those can be brought to the light of day.
Well, David, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect. We had him on when his book Chain of Title came out, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And you can find his piece, Michael Bloomberg and the Dangers of Any Blue Will Do Politics, at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with Dave Leventhal, editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity. Today we are talking about Michael Bloomberg's record, his policies, and his endless campaign spending. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our coverage of presidential candidates by talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about Joe Biden. Last week, we talked about Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg. And you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Also, if you are voting next week, Super Tuesday, and you are no party preference and you want to vote for a Democrat, you have to request a crossover ballot. So be sure to do that. You've got to request a crossover ballot. And you can also vote, register to vote on Election Day. That's also really important to get the word out. Today, we are talking about Michael Bloomberg's record, his platform, and his election spending spree. We're joined by Dave Leventhal, editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity, an independent investigative journalism outlet. They do excellent work on money and politics. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, hello. I think the Democrats, at least the Democratic establishment, wants to commit suicide. If Bloomberg, by any chance, got to be the nominee, I doubt very seriously that he could beat Trump. But it just shows you how much the Democratic establishment is willing to go to stop Sanders at any cost. They're willing to. They'd rather have Trump than Sanders in the White House. I mean, that's clear from the way the Democratic establishment has done this. I don't know why Bloomberg wants to be president, but I think one of the factors is this. You know, if Sanders gets elected, he's going to take a hit on his taxes, because I ask maybe one question that ought to be asked about Bloomberg is, hey, are you willing to rescind the Trump tax cuts? You know, that should be a debate topic, it would seem to me, because that should be the pledge that they all should take. Yeah, I'd be willing to overdo the Trump tax cuts and see what the candidates have to say. I think Sanders is probably, and maybe Warren, are probably the only two people who would do that. So, you know, their hope is they get this to a brokered convention. They're hoping to stop Sanders, and he's one of the guys who might be able to do it. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see what happens in South Carolina.
Well, thank you for that. Dave, what are your thoughts on this? It looks like, according to a couple outlets, that Bloomberg is talking about repealing the Trump tax cuts.
And it's possible, too, and I wouldn't be surprised if this, in fact, did come up, this very issue. It did come up in this week's debate, one of the other points that the caller made, absolutely everyone should expect that beginning now, don't even wait for the debates, that Michael Bloomberg is going to absolutely unleash a torrent of spending on Bernie Sanders directly. He's not going to worry about Joe Biden. He's not going to worry about Elizabeth Warren. It's all going to be about Bernie Sanders. You saw a preview of that today when Michael Bloomberg was really dinging Bernie Sanders on his record with guns. Some of his support from gun rights advocates in Bernie Sanders' previous political iterations. But Michael Bloomberg, if he wants to spend $10 million, $50 million, $100 million just directly going after Bernie Sanders, which is more than Bernie Sanders has spent during the entire campaign, Michael Bloomberg can do that. He can do that now. He can do that over the next few days. And he can do it at a level that has been unseen in U.S. politics at any point in history. So Bernie Sanders has a lot of flack coming his way very, very soon, and it's because Bernie Sanders has been so successful in the polls. It's because Bernie Sanders has won victories where Michael Bloomberg has not yet. And Michael Bloomberg's strategy all along has been to be victorious or to do well enough to continue forward in the Super Tuesday states. So Michael Bloomberg has a lot at stake over the next 8 days right now to get himself in a position to be viewed as a contender, if not a winner, in the Democratic primaries, and if he doesn't take that opportunity and that money that he spent has gone for naught, then Michael Bloomberg could be in a very marginalized position and perhaps on the outside looking in.
I want to ask you about a story that ran in Politico recently by David Siders, and it's called Bloomberg Quietly Plotting Brokered Convention Strategy. He writes, Michael Bloomberg is privately lobbying Democratic Party officials and donors allied with moderate opponents to flip their allegiance to him and block Bernie Sanders in the event of a brokered convention. The effort, largely executed by Bloomberg's senior staff-level advisors in recent weeks, attempts to prime Bloomberg for a second ballot contest at the Democratic National Convention in July by poaching supporters of Biden and other moderates. This is according to two Democratic strategists familiar with the talks and unaffiliated with Bloomberg. What are your thoughts on this, Dave?
We're going to be hearing a lot about brokered conventions, and we're also going to be hearing a lot about superdelegates. Remember them? They were such a big deal in 2016. Well, they're in lesser form than they were then now, or lesser form now than they were then, but at the same time, too, there are hundreds of these superdelegates who are available who can kind of swing their allegiance to whoever they please. So in the sense of having a brokered convention in 2020, were that to come to pass, they would absolutely be playing a starring role. Now, we're beating up on Michael Bloomberg a little bit about this issue, but you can also fully expect that if it gets to that point, that all the other candidates who are still in the race would be doing more or less the same thing. By its nature, a brokered convention, which would be something that we've never seen in very modern political history, would be horse trading. It would be alliance. It would be political survivor in a very real way, and you could have what would be 1, 2, 3, maybe 10 or more different ballots. The convention would mean something. The convention would be where all the action was, and a president would be picked on the convention floor. So that may seem like a anti-democratic thing to many people out there listening to this show or watching the primary, but you saw in the last debate before the Nevada caucuses that all the candidates up there on the stage, save for Bernie Sanders, were willing to let this process play out and go to the convention floor for a brokered convention if ultimately nobody had a majority of the delegates going into the convention. And Bernie Sanders, for example, just simply had a plurality as opposed to a majority.
Well, Dave, I know we have to let you go. So as always, thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity. They do incredible work on money and politics, workers' rights, and other issues. Today, we are talking about the record and the policies and the endless spending of Michael Bloomberg. Now, I would like to welcome Blake Zeff to the show. Blake is an independent journalist who's covered New York politics and Michael Bloomberg's terms as mayor. Blake's forthcoming film is Lone Wolves. It investigates the origins and effects of the student debt crisis in the U.S. Hi, Blake. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you, Blake. Since you covered Michael Bloomberg as mayor, what issue do you think deserves more attention? Well, we'll definitely talk about stop and frisk, and that's now finally getting a lot of attention. But what else deserves attention?
You know, I think that that obviously is a huge one, and I'm glad that we'll be talking about it. You know, another one that I think doesn't kind of come up as much on a national stage, and I don't know if you'd call it an issue or an event that happened, but I think it's very instructive about Bloomberg, the man, which is in New York City, the voters had decided that they wanted term limits for their mayors. So they had a referendum in which the voters said, you can only have 2 terms if you're the mayor. Well, Bloomberg decides around 2008, as he's approaching the end of his second term, that he really, really wants a third term. So what does he do? He engineers a backroom deal where he gets the city council to sign off on a new policy where he can run for third term. One of the sweeteners he gives them is that they can also run for an additional term because they were also term limited. And they do this over the will of the voters. Now, how did he have set the political climate for this to happen? Well, a couple of ways. One, he donated very generously to a number of nonprofits and charities in the city of New York, and then they then testified to the city council and to the public saying what a great idea this was. And most voters had no idea that these organizations were getting paid. They just heard that the local arts organization or the anti-homeless organization or a criminal justice reform organization were all saying that this was a good idea. Secondly, he's a billionaire, as we all know, and so are the publishers of the big newspapers in New York. the Daily News was run by Mort Zuckerman, Murdoch had the New York Post, and the Sulzberger family had the New York Times. These newspapers never agree on anything in terms of the editorial pages, but Bloomberg was able to meet with all of them individually. Again, they're all billionaire buddies, and they all decided this was a great idea for Mike to run for a third term and to overturn the will of the people, and they would all come out and endorse the move on the same day, on the day that he announced that he was thinking of doing this. So again, that also set the stage and the climate for him to do this without the public sort of, you know, maybe having the normal outroar that they would. He also was donating generously to many other groups and individuals so that the normal outrage that you would have when something like this would happen, it just didn't happen. He was able to, you know, in some ways, assure silence from your usual kind of dissenters on these kinds of things. So, I don't know if you'd call that an issue, but I think that that event or that story tells you a lot about the way Michael Bloomberg uses his money, both politically, but also to govern, and also the kind of, the ego and ambition that he has.
Yeah, definitely. You've been tweeting about this, saying that he gave to a lot of churches, for example, and other politicians, a lot of nonprofits. But I do wonder, when he first ran as mayor in New York City, how do you explain his victory?
Yeah, that was a fascinating time. So this is literally 9/11. So, you know, the primary... Well, let me back up. Bloomberg had been kind of a man-about-town businessman. He was not politically involved much at all, but he kind of knew everyone in the city because he was very wealthy. And, you know, he was nominally a Democrat. He would give to the arts and things like that. But he looked at the field. He decided he wanted to be mayor. No one took it seriously. He looked at the field and realized that he wasn't going to win a Democratic primary because there were three or four very established Democratic politicians, all of whom were popular and all of whom had pretty solid bases of support. He just wasn't going to make his way through there. So he said, you know what, I'll run on the Republican line. You know, funnily enough, New York had just had a Republican mayor in Rudy Giuliani, but that was really seen as an anomaly. The Republican Party in New York basically didn't exist. And so Bloomberg was able to, technically he did have an opponent in that primary, but it was one kind of washed up politician, and it was very easy for him to win the Republican primary. And the idea was that he would have a straight shot into the general election. So he got into the general election by bypassing the Democrats, and he was up against a Democrat named Mark Green, and Green was up by 20 or 30 points just weeks before the general election. But on the day of the primary, the Democratic primary, that is literally when 9/11 happened, and it was in New York. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine the city was just, you know, shaking, and people were terrified. They were concerned about security. They were concerned about rebuilding the city financially. And so Giuliani, the Republican, endorsed, you know, Bloomberg, the Republican. And at that point in time, Giuliani never had more credibility with the city than he had right after 9/11, because he was kind of a divisive and unpopular mayor before 9/11. But on 9/11, as we all know, he became, you know, America's mayor. People, you know, saw him as a hero. So that endorsement really helped on the argument of security and safety. And then Bloomberg was able to make the case that I'm a businessman, so I can help us rebuild the economy as well. And that was persuasive. But of course, none of this would have happened if not for the fact that Bloomberg spent $80 million on this mayoral race.
Wow.
In the span of about 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Wow.
And so, you know, because from the time of the primary to the general election was maybe a month. And he just spent tons of money on the Rudy Giuliani ads and, you know, making his argument of being a businessman. And that was a perfect storm that really helped him win by, I think it was 2 or 3 points.
Hmm. Blake, I wonder what you think about the emails that we're getting right now. And again, we should say that Bloomberg supported the reelection of George W. Bush. So from Leona, she says, Bloomberg is running to beat Trump. Please, please, please do not tear him down. He may well be our best and last hope to save our republic. And then we have another email from Alan, who says Bloomberg should run as a Republican against Trump. There are many Republicans that think Trump is running the country into the ground. Should Bloomberg end up with a Dem nomination, he'll have to go against Trump either way.
You know, those are both great thoughts. I mean, in terms of running as a Republican against Trump, I always thought that was a really interesting idea, too. If Bloomberg was really committed to bringing down Trump, I don't think he could win a Republican primary, but he could do a lot of damage to Trump, along the way. And then not, you know, potentially block a Democrat if the Democrats are, you know, really the party that he identifies with now. In terms of the first email, this is a really, really, really important email, and I'll tell you why. Bloomberg's entire strategy is, and you'll notice this, he really doesn't want to be part of the Democratic primary. He wants to skip right to the general, which is, as I just mentioned to you guys, what he did as mayor. was avoid a primary and skip right to the general. He can't literally do that this time. He's got to run in the Democratic primary, but if you look at his messaging and his strategy, it's always about Donald Trump. It's always about how I want to beat Donald Trump. I'm going to go against Donald Trump. Think of me as Donald Trump, as Donald Trump's opponent. And the reasons for that are a few. One, it makes him seem like a general election candidate already. So you've got the person who emailed you saying, don't tear down Bloomberg. He's the nominee. Well, no, he's not. He's still got to run in a primary, and you could choose any other Democrat. Bloomberg wants you to think that attacking him is good for Trump, but he's not Trump's opponent yet. Secondly, Bloomberg knows he's got a toxic record when it comes to a Democratic primary. This is a guy who called for keeping the minimum wage down, who called for cutting Medicare. Not you know, some candidates are calling for Medicare for all. They want more Medicare. He wanted less Medicare. He wanted to cut it, cutting Medicaid, finger-stamping SNAP recipients, that's people with food stamps. I mean, a lot of policies that Democratic, and then, you know, we could talk about stop and frisk, but just a lot of policies that are not going to do very well in a Democratic primary. So for him, if he can pretend he's already in a general election with Donald Trump, then he can avoid discussing those types of issues, but also, really crucially, appear like he's already the nominee. And therefore have a lot of us say, don't attack Bloomberg. That's just helping Trump. He's our Democratic nominee. Well, no, he's up against four or five other Democrats now, and it's worth, you know, comparing his record to theirs.
Right. And then there's another piece at The Intercept about how he spent a decade demanding cuts to Social Security. I want to make sure we have time for stop and frisk, because this policy really brutalized so many people, communities of color in New York City. And hashtag, if you're on Twitter, even if you're not, if you go to Twitter and just search hashtag my Bloomberg story, the stories are harrowing. People writing home from work, people walking, people going to a party, and all of a sudden they're stopped, they're thrown up against the wall. Some people say, this still affects me, I went home crying. I mean, the stories are absolutely horrendous. So can we spend a little bit of time talking about this? There's a great piece by Raina Sultan at Vox, and she reports that from 2002 to 2013, police stopped and questioned more than 5 million times. It was a 605% increase in the use of stop and frisk. The vast majority were black and brown and innocent of any crimes.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I don't even know where to start, so I'll just kind of walk through it, and you can kind of interrupt if you want to push me to a different place, because there's a lot to cover here. Let's start from the beginning. In 2002, Bloomberg begins as mayor, and the policy stop and frisk does exist. It exists already under Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who your audience surely knows who that is. And, you know, they can decide whether the fact that Giuliani had started it is an endorsement of the policy or a condemnation of the policy. And the policy was to stop people, and, you know, by the cops, is the cops stopping people and frisking them and asking them lots of questions. And all they had to have as a reason for it was what they called furtive movements. If the person engaged in a furtive movement, and that's a very subjective term, but they took it to mean, the NYPD testified later, that that can include just looking the wrong way, reaching into your pocket, appearing fidgety. So Bloomberg inherits this policy, and it predominantly targets black and brown New Yorkers, as you mentioned. I'll get into that in a minute. But at that point, there were around 90,000 stops a year. Pretty high number. But under Bloomberg, it skyrockets each year to the point in 2011 where it's almost 700,000 stops a year. So if Bloomberg says he inherited the policy from Giuliani, that's true, but he greatly expanded it. Keep in mind, new mayors come in, they can stop the policy if they want. He decided to continue it and then expanded it on steroids to the point where there were 700,000 stops in 2011. He then also says that he, you know, curtailed it by 95%. I'm not sure where he's getting that math. What did happen was in 2013, it did go down dramatically, but that's because a federal judge ruled it unconstitutional, a decision that Bloomberg actually appealed. So they did begin to roll it back in 2011, a few years before that decision, in fairness, but nowhere near where it had to go down once the courts got involved. So that takes away that. The other thing that Bloomberg says is that he apologized for it, and this is really where he's stretching the truth, because all throughout his tenure, he was pushing this policy, and you had civil rights groups, you had really people across the spectrum, you know, largely people of color, but also plenty of white people saying, this is an abomination, this is a violation of civil rights. And he would be defiant and basically accuse his critics of wanting to open the door to the quote-unquote bad old days, whether it be violent crime, and that if he got rid of stop and frisk, murders would go up and he would have his editorial allies, the New York Post and the Daily News, post these editorials essentially accusing his critics of wanting to, you know, open the door to crime. And so eventually, after he has to curtail the practice, he leaves office in 2013. New mayor comes in, and in 2014, they really, really roll back the policy, and crime continues to go down, and in fact reached record lows in New York City, which basically proved that you did not need to do this. Mm. And at that point, Bloomberg remains defiant. But a couple of years later, the Daily News, one of his staunchest editorial allies, had this big attention-getting editorial that said, we're sorry, we were wrong about this. We said that if you got rid of stop and frisk, crime would go up, and we were wrong. Bloomberg continues to be defiant. Even in 2019, last year, he gave a speech at the U.S. Naval Academy continuing to say that stop and frisk was the right thing to do. Fast forward to November of 2019, just a couple of months ago, he finally apologizes to a black audience in Brooklyn and says he was wrong. 7 days later, he announces he's running for president. Hmm. So a lot of people, when he said he apologized, okay, he eventually apologized the week he decided he was running for president. But for many, many years, he was defiant. One last point on this, because you talked about the practice itself. This wasn't just, you know, getting people on their way to work or other places. I mean, this was happening, black men on their way to and from church. Black teenagers on their way to school. Can you imagine? On their way to school. And we would hear reports of black men who's, you know, were going to work and their work clothes were became really dirty and rumpled because they were thrown on a filthy sidewalk and made to lie, you know, face first on a filthy sidewalk. So this is something that was happening under Bloomberg's New York. And I this is really the last point because I think this is so shocking. In 1 year, I believe it was 2011, Bloomberg's NYPD stop and frisk more young black men in New York City than there are young black men in New York City, meaning that on average, every single young black man in New York City was stop and frisk that year and some more than once.
Wow.
I mean, that tells you how pervasive this practice is.
It really does. And I want to do a show about this because, again, the stories are harrowing. James Richardson, who's 54, told Vox that because of his stop and frisk story or experience, he is anxious every time his son and daughter leave the house without him. I mean, that's just horrendous. So we're going to do a show about that. Two more things, and we're almost out of time, but this is really important, Blake, since you covered Bloomberg. This is not getting as much attention, but Al Jazeera has a piece about calls growing for Bloomberg to apologize for the surveillance of Muslims. Mm-hmm. And an award-winning 2011 investigation by the Associated Press found that the NYPD mapped mosques and Islamic centers, eavesdropped on conversations, surveilled entire neighbors, and put informants known as, quote, mosque crawlers in Islamic places of worship and gathering centers. Can you tell us the role that Bloomberg played in this?
Absolutely. I mean, this is another thing that, you know, this, keep in mind, he comes into office right after 2001, right after 9/11, and there is a lot of hysteria going on throughout the country, and you can imagine in New York City as well. But what's interesting is that it is not the case that most New Yorkers were clamoring for the policies of George W. Bush, right? We remember the quote-unquote war on terror and all those kinds of things. And, you know, there was a little mini controversy in New York where there was talk of placing a mosque opening like a couple of blocks from World Trade Center, if you remember. This became like a national controversy, and New Yorkers were totally fine with that. Well, Bloomberg's under Bloomberg, the NYPD becomes more and more of a it goes from being a police department to more of these kind of this militarized model that we saw, of course, also in Ferguson and throughout the country. This really came to take shape in New York, where the NYPD was constantly getting bigger, bigger, and bigger, and, you know, using 9/11 and these international threats as justification for getting bigger and bigger and beefing up everything. And then, you know, towards the end of his tenure, it comes out, as you said, I believe it was a Pulitzer Prize winning expose about this process to really monitor Muslims. And if I remember correctly, it wasn't just in New York City, it was also in the environs. So you have the NYPD branching off into New Jersey and neighboring states that aren't even in their jurisdiction, trying, you know, spying on mosques and Muslims to see what they're up to. And this was just an unprecedented expansion of police power.
Final thoughts, other issues, the issue around homelessness. Some people say that The numbers, let me just find the numbers here. When Bloomberg took office, according to Salon, in 2002, there were over 5,000 homeless families. By the fall of 2013, there were close to 12,500 families living in shelters. So what happened there? Did he expand the shelters, or did homeless and the homeless numbers stay the same, or did the homeless numbers go up under his tenure?
You know, so they did go up. One thing, just to put that in context and in fairness to Bloomberg, is every mayor in New York City has had a terrible time trying to combat homelessness. Bill de Blasio, his successor, who, you know, is far more progressive than Bloomberg, has also had just a very difficult time with this. And New York City has become very unlivable for people who don't have a lot of money, much like, you know, San Francisco and other big cities. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think really needs more attention when we look at the Bloomberg record and how that contributes to homelessness and poverty in general is just the draconian policies that he was putting into effect. I think I mentioned before he wanted to fingerprint those who are getting SNAP benefits or food stamps. He was constantly trying to add barriers and tests for people to get benefits. We talked about Social Security. We talked about Medicare. We talked about Medicaid. I mean, putting aside the substance of it, just the optics of one of the richest men, arguably the richest man in the city, and I believe the ninth richest in the country, going out of his way to constantly impose regressive policies and taxation is just staggering. And for him to do this and run, you know, to be the Democratic nominee for president is really, really something. And I'm sensitive to the email from one of your listeners who said, well, don't criticize him because he could be running against Trump. Well, he's not the Trump opponent yet. There's still plenty of time. If you think that these policies are abhorrent or, you know, against what you believe in, you can vote for someone else. If and when he becomes the nominee against Trump, then I think it's appropriate to train your fire on Trump if beating Trump is your sole agenda. But this record in a Democratic primary, I think, is really worth scrutiny, and it's not going to show up in those commercials that Bloomberg runs over and over again.
And it's so fascinating, Blake, because he has a lot of support among black politicians, but a number of communities of color and people of color say there's no way they would vote for Bloomberg because of his record.
He's got a very, very sophisticated advertising campaign and grassroots. I shouldn't say grassroots, but the illusion of grassroots, because he's got endorsements, he's got community groups. He's going to be able to acquire a lot of people who are on his side, in addition to all those commercials echoing how great he is. That's why I think it's important, you know, the kind of journalism that you're doing, to just give the full information. I'm not just telling people who to vote for, as you and I are talking. I just want to make sure that the full information gets out to the people so that they can make the decision that they want and not just get one-sided, advertising.
Well, Blake, thank you for your reporting. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Blake Zeff is an independent journalist who covered Michael Bloomberg's terms as mayor. We just got an article from Vicky, and it's in Newsweek. Bloomberg to pay hundreds of people $2,500 a month to praise him on their personal social media feeds. Thanks for that, Vicky. We will put it up at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, Joanne Marr, our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.